This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. So who were the people that you were getting up and having a go with? Who were your contemporaries as an open spot?
Who are my contemporaries in an open spot?
I always worry about asking this question because, like, when people ask me who are my contemporaries in an open spot, the first people I think of are the famous ones.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're the ones who are now famous. And then, consequently, I feel like the answer to the question always has an undercurrent of, and I clearly didn't do as well as them.
There is that, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Simon Evans.
Brilliant.
I mean, Andy Parsons was by no means, you know, he was taking the Jackson's Lane course, so he obviously didn't have that much work. But at least he was somebody that could actually do stand-up, because I find a lot of people that teach, you know, stand-up comedy are the ones that have not got any work because they can't do stand-up.
Okay.
Who else was my contemporaries? I can't remember. Do you know that? I don't know. I think most of them gave up, the people that I started out with. Mm-hmm. There are not many. I know on my actual course was Liz Webb. I don't know if you know Liz Webb.
She did
stand-up for a while and is now probably something like head of drama at the BBC or something.
Brilliant.
Like that.
She's completed it. This is my new thing, by the way. It's like no one quit. You can quit stand-up. It's possible to give up stand-up, but the good way to think about it is completing stand-up.
Yeah.
Like, that's always the thing. If at any point I stop, I'll think to myself, I've completed it.
Yeah. I honestly can't think who my contemporaries were.
Well, let's talk about you being an open spot. What were your first forays into material? If you were starting from the point of view of you open your mouth, you say things that are clangingly, that are funny because they're not jokes.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about that.
I did try and write jokes, and I tried to write routines, but they were all. I was coming from a very dark, kind of screwed up place. They were all kind of quite nasty and dark. And I can remember one of my early jokes, which never got a laugh. And every so often I bring it out because I still think it's funny. One of my early jokes was, I was very upset when my father died. I had to find somebody else to be a disappointment to.
That's nice. That's good. But it's so doubly bleak. It's quite hard to laugh at. But it's a lovely joke.
Yeah, there was stuff like that. You know, there was some joke about committing suicide and my father correcting the spelling on the note, giving me 2 out of 10, poor effort, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It was that sort of, there was lots of kind of, you know, dark jokes about that. And also I did quite a lot of jokes about the awkwardness of being working as a photocopy repairman. When, you know, you're clearly only 5 minutes away from injecting yourself with anything you can possibly get hold of. And then trying to sort of put on a suit and turn up at an office and be a professional.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of jokes about that. I used to have to work for the Royal Institute of the Blind. Mm. I used to have to go and repair their photocopier. And there are lots of jokes, obviously, about how do they know it's not working?
Sure, you
know,
sure,
how
sure.
do they know I've fixed it? But the thing that got the biggest laugh of the whole thing was I was very uncomfortable with blind people because for instance, once I'd be coming down the stairs and suddenly a big group of blind people would round the bottom of the stairs and come up to me. And I was so awkward in the world. Mm. I wasn't able to just go, oh, sorry, excuse me, I'm here. I would think, Jesus, they don't know I'm here. Or, oh, it's so awkward. And I kind of press myself up against the wall and hope they could go past without seeing me, without hearing me. And so I used to do a whole routine about how awkward I was with it all, with that sort of disability. And, you know, and they'd be sort of walking past, you know, obviously with their heightened senses going, Jesus, the photo of Ryan's a bit weird. He's pushed up against the wall. He thinks we don't know he's there. Lots of stuff like that, which was, you know, probably too not PC enough to even work these days.
Sure. Well, let's talk about the tour then that you you did with Sean Collins, which you cheekily called "Still on the Road Show" in the McIntyre font, which is a brilliant move. Whose idea was that?
That was my idea. I've got to admit that.
That's wonderful. Well, you don't need to admit. You should take pride for that. That was brilliant.
Still on the font. But it's basically lying. That's what it is.
Well, no, you were. I mean, was Sean on the road show?
Yes, he was.
Well, you're not lying, are you? That's
no. It was
brand
great.
Attribution. There must be a name for it. I'm sure someone marketing wise knows it.
The reason I think probably Sean and I got together because I did most of the live McIntyre road shows. I did all the, because they needed an extra act on each show.
Okay.
In case somebody screwed up, basically.
Okay.
So in case somebody screwed up, they could edit that act in and they'd still have a full show.
Sure. Okay. Gotcha.
So. But before, every
so you were going out and being on stage and doing well in all those gigs, and then not being on telly.
Yeah.
Wow, how was that?
Well, it was all right because I knew I was going to be on one of them.
Okay, fine.
I knew I was going to be on one of them. Well, they booked me for it, and then afterwards they kind of went, "Hang on, do you want to kind of do some of the live ones?"
Oh, great. Okay, so it came. So, it wasn't like being the warm up man and then being
no,
told.
No. It was in fact it was better because it meant that I got a bit of practice before I actually do my bit. Although
that's a great way.
Sadly, the one that they did record wasn't the best one by any stretch. Anyway, never mind.
Sure.
The great thing about that was before each show, all the acts would come and do photographs for the publicity of the show, and then one act would stand out, and I'd go in, okay, and they'd do those photographs.
Yeah.
Okay, and then another act would stand out.
Amazing.
So that no matter who died or whatever screwed up, they still have a full set of publicity shots. Okay. But of course, the poor old acts didn't know this.
Yes.
So they didn't know this was happening. So, for instance, when Sean turned up to do his one at wherever it was, Bristol, I can't remember where it was. He went, "Oh, what are you doing here? You're not on the show." And I went, "Oh, I'm just here in case anyone dies," you know, and explained to him the situation. And he went, "Oh, okay." So, because then we do the photographs, we send the photograph this, and I'm stood at the side, and the photographer goes, "Okay, Sean, can you stand out?" Right?
Oh, man.
And he goes, "What?" And I'm going, "Looks like you're the weak link, Sean."
Brilliant.
Which of course I did the same joke to on every show.
Yes, of course.
To the first poor soul that
wonderful.
Stood out. I went, "Looks like they're worried about you."
Oh no. That's priceless. But yeah, what a great way to do it though, to get the practice at doing those rooms and the practice of being part of it. And there must exist a lot of unused TV footage of you doing really well. How frustrating.
Yeah, frustrating. Yeah.
God. So you and Sean got together and then made your own. How many dates was that? Is that the only poster? Is that the only time you did it? I seem to remember.
No, we did it first off with. We did it with a different agent first off.
Okay.
Because no one was really interested. We did a small run of about, I can't even remember actually, possibly about 15 dates.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that went okay, we carried it on and did it with a Comedy Store.
And the premise of the show was that, from a marketing point of view, it's two guys who've been on the road show, who are great comics, touring a doubleheader. That's the thing. Now,
it kind of wasn't really a doubleheader. What it was we both did our kind of best of, and then we both went on together.
And then you went on together. I remember hearing about this. So tell me about that. That sounds fantastic.
That was the bit that really upset me and really made me nervous. And
really?
It was Sean's idea. So
okay,
go on together, because he's much more kind of loose and, you know,
than me.
And more conversational, and I'm more gaggy. And I thought, no, it's going to be horrible. I don't want to do it. But actually, it turned out to be the best bit by far.
Brilliant.
And the bit the audience liked the most.
Yes.
Once I realised that, you know, the idea was, you know, we'd follow on each other's material. You know, he'd do some jokes about seals or whatever that he does, and, you know, and then he'd go, "All right, over to you," and I'd have to kind of follow on in some way.
Okay.
Okay, but once I realised that, you know, actually, the more you screwed up, the more the audience liked it.
Yeah.
The more you couldn't follow it on anything about seals.
That's great. That's I think, what people, what comics and what audiences are realising more and more now. Now that there's so much stand-up on TV, which is perfect and slick and well-edited and never fails, it's those things. It's things like, you know, two people on stage together mucking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And the ACLS gigs.
A lot of mucking
gigs,
about, yeah.
You know, yeah, exactly. You know, but people where they... Yeah, what they want to see is people honestly mucking about, getting things wrong, having a laugh with each other.
Yeah.
You know, all those things that's, you know, you can sort of trace back to I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue, and beyond. You know,
I mean, Sean would do his big story, his routine about being sexually abused by his piano teacher, okay, which is quite a, you know, sort of full on bit of material.
Okay.
And then you'd go, yeah, follow that on, and then I'd either go, before I did stand up comedy, I taught piano.
Lovely.
And then do, or I would do something about, I'd go, okay, so that's a, you know, that's a sort of story about childhood abuse, and here's my stuff about, you know, what a screwed up childhood I have.
Sure.
It was actually what I thought it was going to be really, really difficult to improvise, and because I'm not, I don't do that very much.
Sure.
I stand up stage on my own, you know, and do my stuff. But actually, once you've kind of learnt a few of the tricks of it, I really enjoyed it. I'd like to do it again, actually.
Great.
Yeah.
It's funny, that's the, a couple of times you've mentioned, oh, I'm not that sort of comic, I'm not an improviser, right? You know, I write it down, then I have to do it. And whenever I hear someone say that, I always think, you know, come off it, you're fooling yourself. You know, you're
well,
telling
you might
yourself
be right.
You've got
be right.
some sort of block there that I can't do that. But actually, of course you can. And then you've just described being on a successful tour and improvising your way through the audience's favourite bit of the show every night. Of course you can improvise.
Yes, I can do it, but it's not my comfort zone.
Okay, you know, okay, that's
I feel exposed and uncomfortable, you know.
Sure.
And like I did this blinking private party the other night for a load of posh people. And they didn't want me to do material, they wanted me to, you know, react to them.
Yeah.
And you know, I did it, but I wasn't comfortable with it.
Okay.
I'd rather go, these are my jokes.
Yes.
I did a gig with Jimmy Carr a while back, and it was a big one of those big corporate events, you know, where they'd booked Jimmy Carr and I had to introduce him, and I thought, well, I'll learn something here about doing these big corporate events and how to do it. And he went on and he went, I'm Jimmy Carr, these are my jokes.
Yeah.
I learnt nothing.
He it's interesting, guys. That's all the stories that I've heard about Jimmy is that he would turn up and do new material off a clipboard.
He did,
and
he did that, exactly. Yeah. That.
I suppose if you set that up from day one, this is what you're getting.
Yeah, which he did set up from day one. I remember when he first turned up on the circuit, you know, with a clipboard, walked on and went, you know, here are my jokes.
Incredible. To come back to the tour show, we were talking about that in the context of whether it's possible to tour. You were saying the first time you did it, no one was interested, and then you did it again with a different agent. And you, what kind of venues were you playing on the?
On the first tour, we did the most ridiculously huge venues because we had some strange mainstream agent who just went, yeah, I'll give you a guarantee. A typical guy with a cigar going, yeah, I'll guarantee. And he gave us huge guarantees and put us in massive venues. And, of course, we didn't sell thousands of tickets.
Okay.
Although it was still great. We still had a fantastic time.
Sure. What was your biggest disparity between size of venue and number of tickets sold?
We did the Auburn Arena.
Okay.
I'm not sure how many that seats. I don't know, 1,200 maybe?
Okay.
I think we got 200.
Okay.
So there are 1,000 empty seats.
Oh my God.
I shouldn't be saying this on my podcast. Anyway.
But that was the first one before you were
even so, 200's fantastic. If we'd have been in a small room, people would be going, God, they're brilliant. They're selling out everywhere.
Sure. Yeah.
So then we did smaller rooms, and which is what we wanted to do. In fact, we never would have agreed to it had we known they were putting us in these huge venues.
Yes.
We would have said, no, you must be mental.
God, you didn't know. You didn't know.
No, we didn't know. We just, what did we?
But someone said, hey, there's a tour, there's some money. Yeah, where do I sign?
Exactly, it was exactly
that. I'm not planning to read my contracts, thank you.
I said to Sean, you know, Sean said to me, listen, you know, would you do this? Will you do an empty room for this much money? I think we were on a £1,000 guarantee, so we got £500 each. Mm. He said, would you do an empty room for £500? And I said, yes.
Yes.
And he went, so would I, that's sign.
Of course, God. Okay.
So we did that, and actually we had we enjoyed it, and we kind of, and that's where I learned that it was okay to be on stage with Sean, with his kind of laid-back Canadian style. And I also learned that, you know, I could do lots of stuff about, he's Canadian, for God's sake, support me. He's over here stealing our jobs. You know? And then we did this at the second tour, it's the same tour really, we just carried it on, but in much smaller venues.
Mm.
And we did places that you probably play. We did like the Hen and Chickens in...
brilliant, lovely,
in Bristol.
Yeah.
And he gave us that at the weekend. Not quite sure why, because he runs a comedy club there anyway.
Yes, the Comedy Box.
The Comedy Box, yes. So we had the Comedy Box on Friday and Saturday, and we sold out both nights. But that, how many people does that hold? I don't know.
Yeah.
200 at the most, I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know. So from having a horrendous ordeal at the whole Auburn Arena, you know, you just got to change the size of the room and suddenly we're sold out.
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Which absolutely. Was marvellous. We had a great time. We did the Glee Clubs, which were very good. And we sold out the, you know, in the studio rooms. Again, they're, what, 160, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we sold those out. You know, and some places we did a night in Liverpool. Nobody came. And yet we did the Lowry in Manchester, and
yes.
in the small room, man.
In Salford, they'll be keen to point out that's in Salford.
Sorry, yeah. Salford, yeah. Sorry, yeah. We did that, and they, you know, in the small room, 180 seats, they had to put more seats in.
Yeah.
And so, you know, yeah, I don't know, I didn't understand it. How sure. could we sell really well there and then, you know, 20 miles away not sell any?
Yes.
I don't know.
Will you do it again?
Well, we'll have to write a new show, won't we? That's the only problem with that.
Okay. You were doing your kind of best of
yeah.
greatest hits kind of
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we had lots of stuff to sort of draw on for the double act, mm-hmm. which was good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I really don't know. I hope so. I think we probably both want to do it individually.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I don't know. I've got a... unlike Jimmy Carr, I don't have a plan.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, yeah. I think there's a lot more reactive comics out there than well, not necessarily, you know, that's the opposite of practice.
You know, I know a lot of comics on the circuit get disillusioned and bitter and da-da-da, and, you know, and it's very easy to do, and I do it as well. But it depends where you start out, doesn't it? You know, I can go... oh God, I haven't got my own TV show, and you know, isn't it going badly? And or I could go, God, I used to be a junkie.
Yeah.
Am I doing well? Depends how you look at it, doesn't it?
If you're happy to talk about this, I heard a story about a high profile comic or a higher profile comic
yeah.
using one of your jokes on telly. Now, we don't need to name yes. that comic.
No.
I think it'd be interesting to talk about from the perspective yeah. of how one copes with that situation. Something similar has happened to me and I did nothing yeah, about yeah. it. If you're happy to talk about it, legally speaking and all the rest of it,
yeah.
I'm happy to talk about that. Equally, if you'd rather not, that's fine. We don't need to bring it up.
We'll talk about it a little bit. Basically, when someone nicks your joke and does it on TV, nobody actually cares.
Okay, there we go. I suspected that might be where it goes.
Nobody cares except for me, yes. except for the person whose joke's been nicked. I mean, you know, Joe Pasquale regularly. I've seen Joe Pasquale do 5 minutes word for word of Raven and Timkins' review. You know, absolutely word for word. All that stuff. Take that look off your face. The whole thing. 5 minutes.
Oh my God.
Exactly the same.
Okay.
The thing is, no one cares. Only Raymond and Timkins care.
Yeah.
No one else cares. The yeah. general public couldn't care less. They look at it and go, oh, that's funny. They don't yeah. care who wrote it.
yes, there's never going to be a headline where someone's outed. That's never going to make the front page of a tabloid.
Although there's lots know. Of stuff on YouTube of people being outed.
Yes,
you know, Dave
yeah,
Cook and all that sort of
yes,
stuff.
Yes, of course,
know,
yeah.
Being outed and nicking Louis C.K. stuff. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, somebody nicked it, did it on a big TV show. I phoned him up and called him all the names under the sun. He denied it, then offered me money. then said it was a mistake. Anyway, it would have been left at that had he not... And of course, it went around the circuit like wildfire and everyone was talking about it. And then I was kind of at the point of kind of... I would have called him, abused him a bit more verbally. Mm. But then he turned up one, I was sat in the Comedy Store dressing room eating, and he turned up and started having a go at me about it, saying I was making him look bad. And then I lost my temper and attacked him.
Oh, okay. I have to say, I brought this up not knowing that element of the story.
Okay. I physically lost it with him, and basically I put him up against the wall and what have you. And... in a kind of fit of blind rage. Relax, people out there. I don't think I've hit anyone for many, many years. But that's kind of where it ended, really.
Okay.
I mean, there is no resolution.
Sure.
I mean, you know, I think it should all be forgotten about now, really.
Okay.
I mean,
that's the thing. When this happened to me about a year ago,
it really upsets you badly.
It's horrible. And yeah. Particularly this particular circumstance, it was someone who I knew, I had seen them sit in an audience.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'd worked with him for years. But also, what really hurts you is when you then do that bit, which is the beginning of one of my major routines,
yes, yes.
And people heckle you with, you've nicked that from,
yes.
You know, and then you just explode on stage, and of course you die.
Yes, of course, yeah, absolutely.
Because as soon as you lose your temper on stage, it's all over. So
people at the time were telling me on I alluded to it on Facebook without naming anyone, and
yeah.
Loads of comics said, "Who is it? Name and shame. This is important. This has to be wiped out." All the rest of it,
yeah.
And I just felt if I did name the person, it would look like I was being catty.
Yeah,
the only way to deal with it is to sort of hold your head up high and, you know.
I don't want to drag it all up again, really.
No, and, sure. That's fine.
Let's let it all go. Mm-hmm. To be honest, like I say, it's not important. No one cares.
No one cares.
I'm upset because I've put in the work to write mm-hmm. it. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But. And as you know, that is the hard bit, isn't it?
Mm. Mm.
You know, the sitting for blinking hours and then writing lists and going out on your bike.
Yeah, it's all the cycling. That's what I resent. Do you know how much cycling it cost me to get that bit?
It takes me ages to write a good routine. You know, it comes,
yes.
And once I've written it and then tried it and only a bit of it works, and then. You know, and then I start trying to add bits to it, and then, you know, I go back to all the stuff that I thought was brilliant when I first wrote it, which never worked, and try and add it in. And it all takes, you know, it's organic, it takes a long time.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, imagine how long it took Raymond and Timkins to do all that.
Yes.
And then somebody just goes, boom, I'll do that on my DVD. I'm not sure if he has done it on his DVD. It was a live show, I saw him do it. But, you know, but he's well known for it, isn't he? I mean, there's a fantastic bit of stuff on YouTube, Stuart Lee.
Yes,
yeah.
I saw that show live. That was amazing.
That's fantastic.
Absolutely amazing. What an achievement. You mentioned that you'd been kind of running stuff in at newer clubs with newer clubs for newer material and newer acts. Do you see many newer acts these days?
No.
Do you have a sense of
hardly people? Ever? No, and okay. They don't see me either.
Okay.
Which I find quite bizarre, because when I started, I went round and saw what the kind of, you know, what the main acts were doing. I made it my point to go and see acts and go, "Oh, this is what they do. This is what you need to do to do, be at the Comedy Store or wherever."
Yeah, research. Why not?
Exactly. Whereas now, Comedy Store's a fine example. They always have a couple of tryouts on a Thursday night. People turn up. Not only they don't know who any of the people on the bill are. They don't know. People that play the comp, they don't know who they are, which I find a bit weird.
You know? I wonder if that's because now they're
very insular in their own kind of, they're in their own kind of open spot world, and they don't kind of look outside it, which I find strange.
Yes, I wonder why that is. That could be because they've predominantly seen stand up on telly, so that they think that's
maybe.
Their research, and maybe it's because now as I understand it, the open spot circuit is so hard to leave, so hard to get out of, that it kind of becomes a place that you stay in for longer.
Yeah. But here's a tip for the open spot at the store. I see it. I've done this over a long time, and I see the same mistake over and over again. Somebody turns up to do their tryout at the store, and they've only got 5 minutes. Okay.
Yeah.
Now then, what's the scenario? The absolute best that can happen out of that is they rip the roof off, they absolutely storm it, and Don says, "Brilliant, come and do a weekend."
Yeah, that's the best case, isn't it?
That's the best case scenario, and they can't because they haven't got it. They haven't got half an hour, which is probably what you need to do, you know, 20 minutes. Or they don't do well, and Don says, "Go away," you know.
Mm.
So what are you hoping for?
Mm.
I mean, don't do it when you've only got 5 minutes. And the other thing don't do is don't rush on full of exuberance and go, "Oh, Wembley!" Because the audience immediately go, "Oh, fuck off."
yes, sure. There's a really nice thing when you see an experienced act at the store, come on and treat it like it's...
Exactly.
"Here we go again." Do you know what I mean? In a deliberately world-weary fashion. But it's positive quality, isn't it?
Yeah,
I think it really breaks that illusion to have someone be excited about it.
Yeah. And I think that's a big mistake, to rush on overly excited or overly nervous, maybe.
Sure.
I was terrified when I was in mine. Absolutely terrified. I wouldn't even go in the dressing room, you know.
Really?
Well, those, I was doing the funeral director thing then, in those days.
Oh, okay. This is a character that you did?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, okay.
Well, I would come on and do really deadpan jokes about death.
Okay.
Dressed as a funeral director. Don't know how I came up with that, but I did.
Okay. Was that your first? Was that your first thing? Was that what you started doing at Open Spots?
No. So I just was normal. I was a person doing Open Spots, and then I started doing that. It was a mistake. Basically, I was looking for an image, and I was going for a sort of Wyatt Earp type, you know, one of those long frock coats that they used to wear in the Wild West.
Yep.
Gunslingers and that. And I thought I'd do that, and I got that coat and I walked on and somebody said something like, you know, you look like a funeral director.
And the next time you walked on, you had a shovel as well.
Yeah, I said, yeah, well, I've got a hearse parked out, perhaps I can give you a lift home. and that's, you know, it became that. So.
Mike Gunn, famous non-improviser, just coming up with that.
No, I can improvise a line, but I don't go on stage and improvise routines.
Sure, sure.
You know,
sure.
I just don't. Like, I see people, or maybe they don't, but, you know, I do see people go on and try and kind of improvise a whole routine.
Do you think that sense of I'd better have a look, is that something that still concerns you? That's something I've felt, that as a blandly handsome, generic kind of mid-30s.
It does
male,
concern,
you know,
me, but yeah, but I haven't.
I
got
worry
one.
That. Yeah. Okay.
It concerns me, yeah. I keep thinking, you know.
Yeah. I tell you what's worse than not having, I thought it to myself, what's worse than not having a look is someone that has contrived a look.
Yeah.
That's clearly not them.
Yeah.
Oh, God, and it just sort of sets up this.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretense.
It's a weird thing, you know, if you have a look, especially if it doesn't go well. You know, I've died as the funeral director before.
Yes.
And then, you know, you're stuck dressed as a, you know, there's that idiot.
Digging your own funeral.
There's that idiot. I was once up the creek, and you know, in the days of Malcolm Hardy being, I don't eulogise like everyone else seems to, but I was waiting to go on, and there was an open spot before me who died horrendously, and I was dressed as a funeral director, and Malcolm just trying to push it, just go and stand behind him.
Oh my God.
Which would have been very funny, but I said no, I'm not going to do it.
Good for you. Good for you.
It's not nice.
Any other advice for newbies? Any other common mistakes you see? That was something someone, that was a listener question that they sent in, was about advice, things that you, mistakes that you regularly see made. I think what you said about the store is fascinating.
Yeah,
is there anything else like that?
What happens
people
is
really
you,
like that.
You do the store, and that's actually a really easy gig. It's a very, very easy gig. And you go on, and you think, oh, this is fantastic. How could anyone screw this up? And then the tryout walks on and dies horribly by making sort of obvious mistakes, like being running on and grabbing the mic and starting immediately. It just kind of looks really nervous.
Yeah.
And I can remember years ago I saw Bill Bailey when he was not known, you know. Mm. At Screaming Blue Murder, he wandered on and somebody like heckled him, ignored it completely, bumbled about with the microphone and you know, did a bit of this and plugged in his guitar, and you know, someone else heckled him, ignored that, and then he kind of you know. And then he did a great song, and then he dealt, alright, you heckled me with this, didn't you?
Great.
He dealt with him and he dealt with the other guy as well, so it was
great,
you know, but it was a very kind of, I'm really not bothered about this.
Yeah.
I used to kind of start in a, when I first started doing, I used to walk on and say nothing. Mm-hmm. I'd just stand at the microphone looking a bit gormless and say nothing until somebody heckled.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that looks like a very confident start, but actually I just didn't have a good start.
Brilliant.
I can't think of any. I can remember when I was a tryout and I'd see the main act go on and I'd go, what do they know that I don't know? How come, you know, I'd go on and die and they'd go on and do fine. And I'd go, what is it they know that I don't know? And now I go on and do fine and the tryout says to me, you know, what, and I still don't know what it is. Still don't know what to tell them.
I'm just looking to see if there's anything else to add to that. When was the last time you went up to Edinburgh? Was that the uncut one in 2005?
I've done three Edinburghs. I've done I did a stand-up show, I did a show as a funeral director, and I did the drug addiction one. And the drug one I enjoyed the most because it had a narrative, it had a beginning, a middle and end. It didn't rely on the laugh every, you know, 5 seconds or whatever it is you need for stand-up these days. And it was the easiest to write because it was true. You know, I already had the structure. This is what happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just got to find out what's funny about it. And it was really quite easy.
Would you go up again to Edinburgh? Do you think it has a value? Do you think it has a value for anyone? Do you think
it
has a value
for you? I hate it. Yeah. I find it horribly stressful. I don't drink. I don't take drugs. So even after the show, you know, there's not much fun in it for me. And also, it seems a little bit strange that you should get every comic in the world to do a show at the same time. Because there's some brilliant stuff there, but, you know.
Yeah.
And try and split the audience between everyone. You know, it seems a bit odd. I mean, I did that show in Edinburgh, that drug show, and, you know, it went all right for a month. It wasn't great, you know. I think at some point in every Edinburgh, I've been suicidal at some point during the month. But I then came and did it in London. I did it at the Comedy Store for one night. Okay, I did it one night at the Comedy Store, and I got more publicity, more TV. I got sponsored. The Arts Council gave me a £10,000 grant to do it in schools. Whereas in a month at Edinburgh, no one could give a toss.
You'd spent £10,000 to perform it.
I did.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, on the plus side, I'd done it for a month, so I was able to do it.
Yes.
You know, I could do it. So that's the plus side. You can do a show. Mm-hmm. I think you're probably better off paying to do it, you know, in the little theatre in London, personally.
Yeah.
I would go if I had a great new show idea.
Mm.
I was going to do a show about spam.
Okay.
All those emails you get that say, you know, you've won £10 million or I am, you know, Prince of Bodo and I've got, you know, £10 million and I just need you to send me some money so I can get it out. What?
Yeah, yeah.
All that nonsense. Someone I know is already doing it.
Oh, no. That's just the other thing. Well, at least you know now before you go up to Edinburgh,
exactly,
rather than
yeah.
day one when in the programme
yeah, yeah.
you're under the other show about your
your concept.
I was going to do that. I've been collecting those emails that, you know, you get.
You know. Okay.
Because I think they're intrinsically quite funny. They're always really badly worded and spelled wrong. And, you know,
you'd think if there's millions of dollars at stake, potentially, you'd bother spell checking.
It would. Go on. Yeah. No, the other way I find that I write material is after I've had a great gig and I'm driving home.
Yes.
And I've already listened to all your podcasts. Sometimes I kind of go, oh, I could have added that to that bit, and you know.
Yes.
Sometimes that seems to be a quite creative time for me. I'll come up with stuff.
Yes, I think when you've done a good gig,
yeah,
you're just pure confidence.
Yeah, yeah.
You like, and it wonders. I do worry about how much of the rest of the time my little needling anxieties and worries and all the rest of them they just drag me down. And yet, when you walk off stage, suddenly you feel like, well, that was easy.
Yeah,
writing
yeah.
jokes is easy. I'll yeah. think of a thing, I'll say it, people will laugh. God,
yeah.
what an easy job.
Yeah.
And then that feeling then fades over the duration of the drive.
After you've done the Institute of Frozen Food Products Awards. Yes. And the best, you know, pork pie goes to...
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I can only think of one example of when I've really... done that kind of writing specifically for a corporate and it's
yeah.
really worked well.
Yeah.
It was just something I thought on the way in. And it was just the dumbest little joke, but the relief and the gratitude,
yeah,
really.
Yeah.
It was a laugh of oh, you've said something funny about us. They just
yeah,
loved
yeah, they
it.
Love it. Yeah, they
yeah.
love it.
Yeah.
All the other thing I do is if they've got auto cue, I make them send me the presentation beforehand.
Okay.
Okay,
so you know what everyone else
is
going to say.
And I know, so I know what all my stuff is. I know, it's not a surprise. I don't get the words, so I know the pronunciations of various
gotcha.
Things. And what I do is I then write my jokes, and I then get them to put them on the auto cue.
Oh, that's
so good. That when they're actually there.
Yeah.
I don't actually have to remember any of it.
Brilliant.
It's all...
Brilliant.
And, you know, sometimes they won't, but, you know, mostly they just go... Just go, I'm not doing it then.
If they say, hard boy.
Exactly. It's nonsense, of course. If they say, well, we're not going to do it, you go, I'll do it.
Yeah.
Of course I will. I've got a mortgage to pay. Yeah.